Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, Stephen House sits down with Dr. Mark Dybel, head of the Global Fund, to discuss Australia's commitment to the fund, the global health landscape, and the future of the fight against TB, HIV, and malaria.
So, Mark, welcome to Canberra. You've come at an interesting but somewhat difficult period for Australian aid, with the largest cuts ever. Announced in December, and I'd be interested in hearing how the Global Fund is faring. Is this a problem you're facing from other countries as well, of shrinking aid budgets?
I mean, it's a good question, and there's a global financial slowdown, as you know, at least in some parts of the world, including Europe, which is one of our, it's where two-thirds of the money, or about 60% of the money for the Global Fund comes from. But what we've seen is even in the fiscal challenges countries are having, they're maintaining and even increasing commitments to multilateral organizations, understanding that development is actually in the interest of everyone, that if you want to grow your economies, you need healthy, educated people who have an income and can purchase goods and services and grow economies. So we're seeing actually increases in contributions from countries in some countries in Europe. Canada, I think, is a great example. Gives $600 million over this period for the Global Fund. Australia is around 200 right now. So, you know, we're seeing pretty strong commitments. Even in France, you know, which are very tight economy, President Hollande has repeatedly said in public that the one institution he won't cut is the Global Fund. So despite economic difficulty, we're seeing very strong support. And certainly the Gavi replenishment was a demonstration of that. You know, very substantial increases from a number of countries, 50% increases despite economic difficulty. So I do think, you know, there's been an understanding. Certainly Ebola reminded people that health is actually a global issue. And if we don't engage in those places, it's not only is it a humanitarian, I'm doing good stuff, it's enlightened self-interest.
One of the issues in Australia that I'm sure affects attitudes to the Global Fund is this emphasis of the government on the private sector and on aid for trade. And there's a clear risk there that with a diminished aid budget, funding for health will get cut. And I just wonder how you'd respond to that argument that you know, aid should be focused on growth in the private sector and aid for trade, because that's the way out of poverty.
Well, I actually think that that is one of the reasons that people have remained focused on health and education, because a lot of people are focused on trade. A number of governments around the world have actually put development squarely within a trade relationship. It's not unique, actually. But there's a pretty strong understanding that you don't get economic growth if you don't have healthy, educated people. And you talk to any CEOs and they'll tell you, I can't actually get growth in a country unless you have healthy, educated people. If you look at the graphs for economic growth and health, they're superimposable. They're the same, they're the exact same graph, and that's not surprising. I was talking to the CEO, or the executive vice president, rather, of Bank of America, and explaining, you know, health and education, what we do, and the link between that and economic growth. Just, you don't have to tell me, we all know that. I mean, it's always been the private sector that has pushed for a healthier, better educated population for two reasons. We need them to produce. We need, that's who our workforce is. And then we also need healthy, educated people because that's who your market is. So for business people, health and education are front and center, because without it, you won't get economic growth. There's nothing you can invest in that's going to get you equitable economic growth if you don't have health and education. Our biggest supporters in many countries are not the traditional development world. It's actually the private sector and the generals. You know, the most eloquent people I've heard defend development are commanders in the field and CEOs because they know the importance of it. Last thing I would just mention is the former CEO of Walmart, big company. When I was in U.S. bilateral work, we were developing a public-private partnership, and I asked him why he was interested. And he was like, well, I used to be the executive vice president for emerging economies and forecasting. And you can't see it, but I'm sourcing a lot from Africa, but it's sub sourcing. So I need healthy, educated people, really healthy people, so they won't leave work, so that they're actually producing. Otherwise, I can't get my sub sourcing right. But in 15 years, my internal projections are, if we don't have healthy people in those countries, they're not going to be buying anything, and I can't meet my targets. So, you know, it's really when you look at it, if you want to do trade, you have to do health, you have to do education, or you won't get, there's nothing you can invest in that's going to get you growth. Buildings don't do it.
What about private sector engagement within health and health service delivery? I mean, I think Global Fund's perceived as pretty much working, you know, with governments and through governments. To what extent are you able to promote private sector participation in health? Is that something...
Well, working with government doesn't mean you don't work with the private sector, I think is one of the key points. I mean, we are, the Global Fund is somewhat of a unique institution. It's actually a public-private partnership. We have the private sector as a board member. We have private foundations as a board member. It's a somewhat unique structure, and we were designed around a set of principles which emerged at the turn of the century, which was a new thinking about development, that it had to be results-based, that it had to involve good governance, and you had to have all sectors involved. But importantly, the countries had to lead the effort, because if you can't do things for a country, you actually have to support them to achieve things on their own. So it's in our DNA and actually in our structures that the private sector is a key component of that. There are two aspects of it. You know, they don't have to implement programs necessarily. They just need to engage so that the programs are implemented well. So one of the key areas is innovation, and the private sector has a lot of innovation, especially around areas that are key for health and health systems that will sustain a country, not only as they move from a fragile state to a self-sustaining country, but beyond, you know, when people exit, to still have a system there. And our innovation hub is set around key areas which, as you hear them, will sound very much private sector type of expertise. So financial and risk management, procurement and supply chain, and quality assurance programs, which is really data management and human resource management in a way that allows for maximum output and really following over time what's happening as you're investing, so that you get the return and that you're using the data to improve your systems, in this case, improve your health. So we're working closely with the private sector in each area of that innovation hub to bring the innovations the private sector has developed into our practices. And I think that's hugely important. You know, it's not about implementing. We do have those, and I'll come to those. But it's actually about having their expertise have a huge reach, because it's going to affect all implementers and have governments function more effectively. In that regard, in this region in particular, we have been working with high net worth individuals, which, you know, corporate and high net worth individuals kind of blurred in this region. It's the same thing. So we've been working with high net worth individuals in this region to increase their contributions to health in their countries. And it's working really well. So in Indonesia, a gentleman, Dr. Tahir, has put up $100 million, $65 million for the Global Fund. He got 8 of his friends to give $5 million each. And now he's working on more, and he's actually got more identified, and he'll announce those soon. And then Bill Gates has agreed to match that. So we're getting this huge, you know, investment in Indonesia from the private sector. Now, that's great for the money, but the other pieces of that are as important to us. These people tend to be very influential in their countries. So they're now pressing on the government to increase their contribution for health, because they're putting their own money in. They want the government to do more. And importantly, they're pressing the government on, you need to be more efficient. You need to use your resources better, because I'm matching your resources, and I'm not going to put money unless I know you're getting good outcomes. And what can we do to support you to develop better practices? That's the systemic stuff that's going to change everything. I mean, in the end, it's not sustainable to just have private sector companies implementing external programs. It has to be, how are you strengthening the programs? And the private sector has a key role there, especially around the innovation. But we do use implementers, and have implementers who are the private sector. And Papua New Guinea Oil Search is one, because their reach is one of the largest, or the largest oil company there, especially in remote areas, is pretty significant. In Ghana, Ashanti Gold, which is a mining company, is one of our implementers for malaria programs. That's a great example. I mean, Chevron is a big contributor to the Global Fund. Well, why would Chevron be contributing to the Global Fund and active in our board? Well, the reason is because they know that if they can't control malaria, they can't actually produce oil, they can't actually get the mining done. Same on tuberculosis. The mining companies in southern Africa are very engaged in tuberculosis and HIV because they couldn't get mining done. It's a great example of where health is essential for a productive economy. So across the board, we're engaged in the private sector. Yes, they are implementers and they do a good job, but if you're just an implementer in a country, you're not going to have the systemic reach. What we're trying to do is work with the private sector to get the full scope of their expertise in. And then the last thing is we're bringing private sector expertise within our own function as a multilateral organization. So our CFO, 35 years of experience as a CFO in one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. Our head of procurement was the head of procurement for BMW for all of Africa. And they brought that private sector expertise to our own system. So we now have private sector level, state-of-the-art financial management systems. We now have state-of-the-art procurement systems. We've actually saved $500 million in the last 18 months because of our new approach to procurement, which is taking private sector practice and bringing it into the way we do things. So, you know, the private sector infuses, I mean, it's in every aspect of what we do, from financial contribution to our own management to how we support countries to have the best practices.
Okay, great. You've mentioned already Indonesia and PNG, and I'm sure one argument you've already heard, or one fear, one concern about the Global Fund is that you know, either you have or you will be pulling out of the Asia Pacific, and therefore why should Australia support the Global Fund given our focus on our own region? How would you respond to that kind of criticism?
Well, I would say if you look at the data, there's no better investment if you want money in the Asia Pacific than the Global Fund. For every dollar Australia has put into the Global Fund has invested $15 to this region. So it's for every dollar to the fund, 15 back to the region. It's a pretty good investment. Tough to leverage that. That's not just a historical perspective. It's actually true for this four-year period of our funding, our cycle. So from 2014 to 2017, that ratio is the same as it was in 2002. And we've actually increased the resource commitment in Asia-Pacific by 6.3% over this next 4 years compared to the previous 4 years of dispersed resources. So this is a pretty good investment, you know, 15 to 1 and increasing resource in the community. And the reason that's important, because as you point out, a lot of development organizations are getting out of the region because two-thirds of the countries are in middle income. And we don't have the same kind of stricture. We actually focus on disease and supporting countries to get towards control and elimination of disease. But it's tough. It's very difficult. And to be honest, without Australia's strong voice, it's going to be very tough to maintain that because in the development world, when you move to middle income, there's a real shift in the thinking, and you know, donors in other parts of the world are not as focused on development. They're very focused on geopolitics and other aspects of this region, but because of the income status of many countries, there's much less engagement in terms of financing program and support for traditional development areas. So Australia staying strong here is going to be necessary for the fund really to stay as engaged and invested in this region.
All right, final kind of cluster I wanted to ask you about was you mentioned Ebola. You know, that's brought about increased focus on health systems. We're also moving to post-2015 goals where perhaps there'll be less emphasis on individual diseases and more on health in general. In that kind of context, I mean, do you think the Global Funds are vulnerable, or how are you responding to that changed environment?
I would say if we were still just, you know, only HIV, TB, and malaria myopic, not looking more broadly, we'd be very vulnerable. In fact, the reality is you can't deliver and get towards eliminating those diseases unless you have a system to do it. And HIV, to some extent, was the unique driver in that because it's chronic care delivery, it's chronic care management, and it's actually chronic prevention. Because people are at risk for 50 years and they're in and out of risk at different times. And so you need structures and systems available to respond to the constantly changing prevention needs. But it's also chronic care delivery. And as you recall, during the last development of the Millennium Development Goals, there was no HIV treatment goal initially because people said it wasn't possible. You couldn't possibly build a system for chronic care management in countries in Africa, for example. That's all been proven wrong. But it's not just HIV, it's malaria too. You have to build a community healthcare network to get someone going house by house to make sure bed nets are being slept under. You need integrated case management where you're going out and looking for children with fever and responding to children with fever and having an algorithm so you respond to children with fever. TB, you have got to get people in a community and on treatment for 6 months, and you have to identify them, which is very difficult in tuberculosis because the we have great curative therapy, but we don't, well, good curative therapy, but we don't have a good diagnostic. So it's each of the diseases required systems. And then you need those things we talked about, procurement and supply chain, financial and risk management, and quality use of data in decision making and at the local site so that you actually have a quality program. So, yes, we are investing to eliminate three plagues, two that have been around for since recorded medical history, malaria and TB, and the modern day plague, but we're doing it in a systematic way that's supporting countries to have a health system. There are actually now data out that show that investments, if you look at countries that have had heavy investments in HIV, TB, and malaria, their health is better overall than countries where those investments didn't occur. Because it's a systematic investment. It's not a, you know, we're just doing this and getting out. But it's much more intentional and really looking at that, how you support countries to move, again, from a fragile state to a self-sustaining state, and what are the systems that need to be there for these diseases that are broader. I can also tell you anecdotally that it is those investments that allowed countries to respond well to Ebola. So we focus on the three post-conflict states that didn't do particularly well in Ebola, Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. They have one healthcare worker for 45 to 90,000 people. I mean, there is no system to respond at all. But we tend not to remember who did respond. So Mali, in the midst of a conflict, actually completely controlled. And I was in Mali with Michelle Sidibe and Margaret Chan as the outbreak was occurring. And I'll come back to that. Senegal controlled, Gabon controlled two different outbreaks, Uganda controlled, Lagos in Nigeria, one of the most complicated environments in the world, controlled. So what was the difference? Well, if you look in those places, they don't have perfect health systems, they don't even have strong health systems, but they have enough of a system to respond, and community healthcare workers in places. You know, in the case of Lagos, there was a community network in place that was put there actually for HIV, TB, and malaria mostly, and maternal child health. And then they shifted the rapid response team that was up in the north on polio down into Lagos, and that's, you know, functionally how they control. I was in rural Senegal in a village where the central Ministry of Health, it took us an hour to find the villages because they're not easy to find. But we went into them, and the imam and the tribal leader met us and told us about, you know, how they're responding to Ebola, and they're using the malaria infrastructure that was put in place for the door-to-door net campaigns that's doing the Ebola monitoring. And so we met the woman who was selected by the leaders for malaria several years ago, who goes door-to-door. That's her job. That's what she does, to look for kids with fever. This is actually pretty remarkable. This district had the highest rate of malaria 3 years ago. They haven't had a case in the last year because they're doing this door-to-door campaign. Well, these are the people recruited to respond to the Ebola epidemic. So when you put these things in place, they actually are not just for HIV, TB, and malaria. They're actually for health. And that's a pretty exciting thing. The last thing I notice as we move forward, there's something very exciting to some of us, because health is getting integrated much more than people think. And we're doing great stuff, for example, with UNICEF and UNFPA, so that we have integrated case management for all childhood fever, and we each do our piece. We're going to do that in Democratic Republic of Congo, complicated place, and then 15 other countries, 7 to 15 over the course of the next several years. But if you look at, you know, who's at risk for HIV in some places, now this isn't true in this region, but in Southern Africa, it's young women, adolescent girls and young women. And we really struggled for interventions that will make a difference there. And now four studies show that if you do incentives in a variety of ways, cash transfer incentives, you can keep, and basically functionally to keep girls in school longer, particularly through secondary education, the risk of HIV drops 30 to 60%, which is as good as anything you have. So we can now invest in education, basically, to keep girls in school. Now, not only will the HIV rates drop, but girls won't get married early, they won't get pregnant early, they'll have fewer kids, and then they'll have the opportunity for income. And we know that if a mother has resource, she will spend it on education, health, and nutrition. If a man has it, they won't spend it on that. So then you develop a, you have a true development cycle occurring that has development impact across a whole swath of things. So as we look to the next, you know, what comes next, not only do we need to be integrating health, we need to be integrating health with development. And that's a positive thing that I think about where the post-MDG debate is going, is we shouldn't anymore be focused on individual things. We had to do that 15 years ago. I mean, we weren't investing in development in ways that produce results that could, you know, justify the resource commitment we were asking for. And sometimes you have to go focal early so you can build a base of data to support further investments. But then now we need to look at a person. What's going to happen with a adolescent girl as she becomes a woman with opportunity, and what are the inputs there? And, you know, we can end where we started. Health and education are the primary determinants of whether or not a woman, an adolescent girl, is going to become a woman with opportunity. That's not health. That is actually economic growth and development.
But I have to ask a follow-up. I mean, is the Global Fund of the future then not going to be about the three diseases?
Oh, we're absolutely about the three diseases. No, we're absolutely, that's up for our board to decide, and there, you know, people are looking at that, and it's actually more than our board. There's a global, there's kind of a broader dialogue on that. But there's no contradiction between staying focused on HIV, TB, and malaria, and ending those epidemics, which we need to do. You're not going to have, you know, fully grown, economically developed countries if they have malaria challenging them. If a third of the workforce is out from malaria during rainy season, which happens a lot around here, you know, you're not going to have a fully developed country. So there's no contradiction between investing in these three diseases, these plagues that have massive impact in a country, and integrated health or integrated development. But it's how we put it together to support a country.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks very much, Mark.
Thanks very much. Good to be here again.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.